Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk, the most fact-driven, unbiased, true crime channel. All right, first on the docket, the Murdoch case update, some new recordings. Second, Chad DeBell's attorney finally would like to see the testimony that led to his client's indictment. Third, South Dakota's attorney general is getting some favors on his criminal case from the bench. A trial begins next week, which was 37 years in the making. A motions hearing in the Ahmed Arbery case. What does the judge have to decide? And if you can't trust a nun, who can you trust? And then finally, our dumb criminal contestant of the day, a recap of the contestants throughout the week so that you can choose the dumb criminal contestant winner. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Thanks for watching. If you haven't done so already, please hit that subscribe button as well as hitting that little bell over there in the corner, that's right, so that you receive notifications of when we go live or put up new content. We have a busy docket today, so let's get to it. All right, first on the docket, some new updates in the Murdoch case. Now you may say, hey, Scott, you've been pronouncing this Murdaugh. That's right, I have. That's the way it looks like it's spelled to me. I've even watched news reports from South Carolina, and they pronounce it Murdaugh. But based upon the recordings that I heard from Alex Murdoch, that's the way he pronounces it, we're going to pronounce it Murdaugh from here on out. So, like we've said, as always, we will give you our best advice an opinion at the time, and it will change based upon new information. Now we've got it straight from Mr. Murdoch's mouth, and so that's where we're going from here. All right, now we brought you a little news yesterday regarding a release of new documents in the Murdoch case, and a couple of things that are rather interesting. We have a little more detail in regards to the events that took place back on February 23rd of 2019, which was the initial party where things got started. So Paul Murdaugh, Morgan Doughty, Connor Cook, Miley Altman, Anthony Cook, and Mallory Beach, they all met at Paul's home around 6:30 p.m. to go to an oyster roast at the home of Crystal Cook. They arrived by boat between 7:30 and 8 p.m. that evening. Now, according to a statement from Crystal, no alcohol was served at the event. She said that when the kids arrived, Miley Altman had a White Claw in her hand but threw it away. Her parents were apparently at the dinner. Now, Crystal said that the kids did not seem intoxicated while at the event, and they all left around 11:30 p.m. The timeline created by the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources using data from the boat's Garmin tracking device has the group leaving the oyster roast at 12:11 a.m. The group set out for bars along the Beaufort waterfront and arrived at Henry Chambers Waterfront Park around 12:49 a.m. Now, en route to the bars, the Garmin tracker recorded the boat almost colliding with the Woods Swing Bridge. And a surveillance camera captured Paul and Connor entering Luther's Rare and Well Done Bar at 12:55 a.m. Paul ordered the first round of Jaeger bombs at 12:59. Connor ordered a round of lemon drop shots shortly after, and the boys left at 1:07 a.m. They each took two shots during that eight-minute time period. Paul and Connor met back up with the rest of the group about 1:13 a.m., and they left for their home at 1:17 a.m. According to Garmin records, at 12:20 a.m., there was a decrease, then a spike in the speed of the boat. Witnesses said that when Paul moved to the front of the boat while arguing with Morgan, then returned to the helm and picked up speed. Seconds after the boat plowed into the dolphin pilings at the Archer's Creek Bridge, This was at 2:21 a.m. The boat came to a stop, crashed under the bridge. Now, in interviews, two officers mildly said that Paul, Anthony, and Mallory were thrown from the boat. Paul and Anthony made it to shore. Mallory's body, as we all know now, wasn't found until some 6 days later. Miley said that it took a moment for the group to catch their breath, and then they called 911. Connor stayed on the line with the operator trying to get as much information as possible to the first responders. He and Miley walked to the road and flagged down officers with a light. Morgan was injured in the crash and can be heard in the background of the call panicking about losing blood and finding her friend Mallory. Miley said Paul's main concern was getting in contact with his grandfather, Randolph Murdaugh. When investigators asked Miley why Paul was so adamant about calling his grandfather, she speculated, well, you know, because they're lawyers and stuff. He wanted him to be there first. She said he went back and forth on whether to call his dad, Alex Murdaugh, and eventually he did. Despite many witnesses reporting Paul being obviously drunk, no responding officers administered a field sobriety test at the scene of this crash. Instead, the group was transported to the hospital. We also now know that Miley, Connor, and Paul rode together in one ambulance. Miley recalled Paul being uncooperative and aggressive toward the first responders during the ride. Shortly after they arrived at the hospital, Paul was met by his father and grandfather. One of the nurses recalled Paul's father walking around introducing himself to EMS and ER staff and walking throughout the ER trying to talk to all of the patients involved. A nurse for Morgan recalled that Alex Murdaugh trying to enter her room multiple times while she was being interviewed by law enforcement. Ultimately, as we now know, Paul Murdaugh was charged for boating under the influence, resulting in great bodily harm and death. He obviously was awaiting trial when he was killed. That's kind of some more background on what led up to basically everyone in the country learning about the incident involving Paul Murdaugh. Now, we also know that Paul and his mother, Maggie or Margaret Murdaugh, were shot to death at their family home in Carlton County, South Carolina. That call came in on June 7th. We now have new audio, which is the 911 call released of Alex Murdaugh calling the 911 dispatcher saying that he needs the police and an ambulance immediately. And he states that his wife and his child have been shot badly. The dispatcher connects with the Carlton County dispatcher, who tries to get more information from Alex Murdaugh as they send police to his home. Mr. Murdaugh says that he found the bodies up by their kennel and that neither Paul nor Maggie were breathing. The dispatcher asked if Alex Murdaugh saw anyone in the area, if anyone else was supposed to be at the home, or if anything seemed out of place. Alex Murdaugh said that nothing seemed out of place and no one else was supposed to be there. He repeatedly asks for people to get there as quickly as they can. And ultimately he hangs up near the end saying he needs to call family. You can listen to the calls in their entirety. We'll put them up right here as well. The case involving the deaths of Paul and Maggie Murdaugh is going to get interesting. Just given the people involved, their positions of power that they had, the privilege that appeared that the young Paul Murdaugh tried to use to get out of things. He knew the system, and obviously everybody was somewhat involved. And we don't know yet as if there's any connection regarding the boating incident as it relates to the homicides, but it's going to get interesting. Next on the docket, Chad DeBell's attorney would finally like to get a copy of those grand jury transcripts. Now, why do you want the grand jury transcripts? And I will be fair to Mr. Pryor here. Sometimes the grand jury transcripts are not always prepared at the time of the indictment. It takes some time. But as you may recall, the indictment was dated May 24th of 2021. Now, the motion asking for the grand jury transcripts has been filed, dated July 23rd, 2021. Now, that's only roughly 60 days or so, but normally this is one of the first motions that you file because, as the defense attorney, you want to see the grand jury transcripts. It is going to basically lay out the case that the prosecution presented before the grand jury, and that's going to be an abbreviated version of the case that's going to be presented to the jury. It's also going to have key information that the prosecution is going to rely upon. So you can only imagine how important that would be. Normally, anytime I have a case involving grand juries, this is the motion that is filed forthwith, meaning immediately. Now, Mr. Pryor's also filed another motion asking that a change of venue be granted, and he wants a forthwith hearing on this immediately. However, once again, this is a very boilerplate motion that does not give any specifics as to why the motion for change of venue cannot be granted, other than a conclusory statement saying that venue must be changed so that the defendant can receive a fair and impartial jury, and that they can't do that in Fremont County. Normally, and we've talked about this in the past, you normally want to attach something that says it's so obvious that the defendant can't receive a fair trial. But you normally just can't file a motion saying change of venue. You need to show some sort of data, survey that people have already concluded and made up their mind in the jurisdiction, and therefore a small jury pool and this percentage of people that reside in the county, then looking at what percentage of potential jurors would be called for jury duty, you kind of extrapolate the jury pool that's going to show up. And we've talked about this before. The thing is most judges will say, well, let's wait and see if we can get a jury. So most change of venue motions, they're really not ripe for consideration until the court basically concludes on their own during the voir dire or jury selection process that there basically are not enough jurors in their jury panel to get a fair and impartial jury. But it can usually happen. There's a lot of people that'll say, yes, I'm aware of the case, but I haven't formed an opinion because I haven't heard all of the evidence. And then the jurors will say that I will only make my decision based upon legal and competent evidence, which is evidence admitted in evidence at court to decide the defendant's guilt or innocence. We'll have to wait and see. Next on the docket, the South Dakota Attorney General, I think, is getting a few favors from the bench that neither you nor I would receive. As you may recall, the South Dakota Attorney General, Jason Ransborg, is charged regarding an accident that he had last year where he struck and killed a man on a South Dakota road. Now, defense attorneys have asked and basically tried to say that the individual that was struck and killed by the attorney general's car, a gentleman by the name of Joe Beaver. He was 55 years old. Well, the defense for the attorney general is saying that we think it's a potential suicide. So the defense attorneys, in my opinion, threw a Hail Mary and said, we would like to get the medical records of Joe Beaver so that we can look at it and basically see if he threw himself into the attorney general's car, creating such a mess and all of these charges, what have you. Now, I can tell you, I would love for a judge, as a criminal defense attorney, for this to happen for my clients. There are cases where we've known where we have individuals that were receiving psychiatric treatment, even possibly for the crimes that have been alleged and where these people were the victims. Guess what? I've never seen a case, at least not me personally, at least that I can recall, where the judge has said, yeah, you can get access to those medical records. Short of a defendant signing a release, they are protected via HIPAA. But the judge in the Attorney General's case, a judge by the name of John Brown, has ordered that five medical providers turn over the medical records as it relates to Mr. Beaver. I've never seen anything like this. I don't know why the judge would allow this. I'm not sure what is going on. And the only reason why the defense apparently is aware of it is that Beaver's estate, obviously when they try to resolve the estate, they have to put out a notice to everybody saying who is owed money. And in this particular case, the agencies all stated that they are owed money by the Beaver estate. I don't know. I call me old-fashioned. I just think the old attorney general, although he's given the presumption of innocence and he's only charged with misdemeanor charges in this particular case, I think it's rather clear that he was not being completely candid when he said that he thought he hit a deer. For goodness sakes, Mr. Beaver's glasses were inside the vehicle. I think one could possibly conclude that he had hit a person. And the whole thing just stinks. And I hope for the trust in the judicial process, the Attorney General is not receiving favors that no other defendant would. So maybe it's time for the good Attorney General to resign, but hey, that's just my opinion. You know, if he's cleared of all these incidents, maybe he could then seek office again. But I think the Attorney General in South Dakota should resign. Next on the docket, a murder trial is going to begin next week here in Colorado, and it is 37 years in the making. And the reason why this case jumps out at me and why it's interesting to me is that I remember this case. I remember basically the city being paralyzed and everyone making sure their doors were locked and their garage doors were closed. And that's because of apparently, allegedly, this guy, Alex Christopher Ewing. So it's been 37 years for him to get to trial. Now, Ewing is now 60 years old, and he faces first-degree murder charges in connection with the 1984 death of Bruce and Deborah Bennett, as well as their 7-year-old daughter, Melissa. The couple's 3-year-old daughter, Vanessa, was left with critical injuries but ultimately did survive. And this case went unsolved for decades until DNA testing back in 2018 matched Ewing's DNA. And what makes this particular case so gruesome is that the instrument used in causing the death of all these individuals was a claw hammer. Now, Bruce Bennett's mother, a woman by the name of Connie Bennett, is anticipated to be one of the first witnesses in the case. She is now 87 years old, but she was one of the first witnesses on the scene because she found her badly beaten family after this incident. Now, Mr. Ewing had been serving a prison sentence prior to these murders, but he had been released just 2 weeks before he carried out this heinous crime. And it's also alleged that Mr. Ewing is responsible for the death of Patricia Louise Smith. She was also found beaten with a hammer, and it was also determined that she had been sexually assaulted. As it relates to the Bennett family murder, it's alleged that the family, and it was here in Aurora, Colorado, that they were celebrating Melissa's birthday, and the intruder clubbed Bruce Bennett and then slit his neck when he walked out of the master bedroom. He then sexually assaulted Deborah and beat her with a hammer as well. It's alleged then that Ewing then sexually assaulted Melissa and then beat Vanessa on the head with the hammer as well. She was left in a coma with several facial injuries that paralyzed her on her left side. I think we all know how this trial is going to turn out in light of the DNA evidence in the case, but obviously we'll give Mr. Ewing the presumption of innocence. But I will be watching this case simply because I remember it. And over the years, I have thought about this case, particularly when I thought, did I close that garage door? I better go double check that garage door. And it was because of this case, because they believed Mr. Ewing had entered the home through an attached garage. So lock your garage doors. Make sure they're closed at night. Okay? Please do that for me. All right. Let's take a quick recess. Please go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up for a background subscription service. You'll be happy you did. If there's anyone out there you were ever curious about what was in their background, now is the time to do it. If you're going to get involved with somebody, now is the time to do it. When you go to crimetalksearch.com, you put in the name, literally millions of public records are searched, and a report is generated. And it's going to give you a report. If they have multiple social media accounts, you're going to find it. If they have multiple phone numbers, multiple email addresses, it's going to be found. And more importantly, you're going to get information regarding criminal history. Hopefully the person you're searching has none whatsoever, but if it's there, it's going to be found. You're going to get everything you'd want to know, whether you're going into business or whether you're going into a personal relationship, you're going to be able to find out the information you want to know. So go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up today. You'll be happy you did. Next on the docket, we had a motions hearing in the Ahmaud Arbery homicide case. The three defendants, Travis McMichael, Gregory McMichael, and William Bryan, well, they all showed up in court, and it was basically a whole lot of motions hearings regarding what they call motions in limine. And that's where the court is asked pre-trial to determine what is going to be admissible so as to avoid prejudice that takes place prior to being presented to a jury. And some of it is basically some housekeeping matters. For example, the prosecutors in this case wanted additional time for closing arguments. Not a big deal. Prosecutors, as of now, get 2 hours for their closing arguments. They're asking for 3 hours. The defense has a total of 6 hours, 2 hours for each defendant. The prosecutors were also asking that the district attorney, George Barnhill, who originally had the case, and decided that the case would not be filed, well, that he should not be brought in and allowed to testify for the defense in this particular case. There were also issues regarding Georgia's former citizen's arrest law that was repealed as a result of the Ahmaud Arbery case. Now, we have broken down in previous videos here the law as it relates to the citizen's arrest. These three defendants did not meet the requirements under that particular statute. So it was in place at the time, but I'm still not sure the defense is going to get that instruction because they did not see a burglary take place. In fact, everybody agrees there wasn't one. That's a big problem. And then you can't go and chase down the defendant and then ultimately show up with a shotgun where Mr. Arbery was shot. Now, the prosecutor also wants to shut down the defense from admitting body cam worn videos where basically self-serving statements were made. We talked about this last Tuesday night. Yes, anything the defendant says can and will be used against them. But if the prosecution doesn't bring it in, the defense cannot submit it on their own. It's considered self-serving hearsay. The defense always has to decide then that tricky balancing act of, can I get the evidence in or do I have to have my client testify? We'll see how the judge was going to rule on these. He has a lot of other issues. And once again, the defense wants to introduce evidence of Ahmaud Arbery's mental health. I don't think that's coming in unless there's some nuance in Georgia law that trumps federal HIPAA law. I'm not sure how they're going to get around that issue. And the other big issue is that the defense doesn't want jurors rehabilitated in the voir dire process. Basically, hey, if they state they can't be fair and impartial, let's just get rid of them, keep them coming. Don't try to keep questionable jurors. I totally agree. We'll just have to wait and see. The judge also has to make a ruling on 404B evidence, and that's evidence of a person's prior crimes, wrongs, or other bad acts. And also, like I said, the mental health issues. We'll see that what's going to take place, because the defense has noted that they would likely call a mental health expert. Not exactly sure what they're going to testify to. I really hope that this case will be televised. I think the world needs to see the facts. You know, I get accused of being very pro-defense some days and very pro-prosecution the others. I can't make anybody happy. And in this particular case, I think these three gentlemen are going to have a very difficult time. And I'm just looking at the law. I don't think their argument that they were out doing a citizen's arrest was legal under the law there in Georgia at the time. But we'll wait and see. That's what juries decide. Members of the community decide whether this was the case, whether this particular case where everything was legal or if these people committed felony acts. We'll have to wait and see. Next on the docket. If you can't trust a nun, who can you trust? I know. It's hard to believe. I mean, I think we've all become accustomed over the years about hearing about cases regarding priests. We heard about a case just the other day of a minister helping out one of the flock get a hotel room and maybe providing some illegal drugs and things of that nature. But you don't get many nun cases. Why? Because I think most people see nuns as very good people, right? When I think of a nun, my first thought is, that's Mother Teresa. They can't do any wrong. I never went to parochial school, but I know people that did, and they constantly refer to the fact that they would get their knuckles whacked by the nuns, but at least they knew how to diagram a sentence, all right? And they could spell really well because they were a little bit intimidated and afraid of the nuns. But you don't expect to have a nun plead guilty for stealing school funds. And wait until you hear the amount of this, ladies and gentlemen. $835,000. Most nuns live rather frugally. However, Mary Margaret Krupper pled guilty to taking money from the St. James Catholic School in California over a 10-year period. And it all ended back in September of 2018, but apparently she took advantage of her position as principal at the school, where she was responsible for its income, which consisted of tuition fees and charitable donations. She apparently diverted the funds, some $835,000, for some personal expenses, including gambling trips. That's right. Apparently, Sister Mary Margaret Krupper was living a double life. Now, I've said this before. That's why you got to get a background subscription service, right? But everybody has a double life. Everybody has a secret. And Sister Mary Margaret Krupper had a big secret, that she likes to gamble, live large on the credit cards, to such an extent that she spent approximately $835,339 of the Catholic school's money. Now, the Archdiocese in Los Angeles had only the statement to say that the community of faith at St. James was shocked and saddened by these actions. Now, this is where it's going to be interesting. At sentencing, which is set now for February 7th of 2022, U.S. District Court Judge Otis D. Wright had set the sentencing now for February 7th of 2022, when he would expect her to make a statement, which is kind of off because the defendant never has to make a statement, even a statement in allocution at sentencing. And the court stated, quote, "I don't have to worry about BS coming from you," end quote. Now, he said this from the bench. Wright also said that someone who has been educated by nuns, unlike most cases, this one will be a struggle, because the judge says, "I don't look at nuns as ordinary people," which is kind of what I was saying, right? You just don't expect nuns to steal from people. And frankly, Judge, I don't think you can necessarily trust what's going to come from the nun's mouth, because she stole $830,000. So she is an ordinary person, which is sometimes the problem when we hold people in high regard, is that they use that position of trust to take advantage of us. Tough case. We'll see what the judge does. We'll definitely be following that one in February of 2022. But maybe the nun has reduced herself to the position of our dumb criminal contestant of the week. Not that far. Our dumb criminal contestant of the day is Judith Black. Now, there's something about food. It's kind of a theme. It's a trend. I'm not sure why people get that upset about their food. Well, Miss Judith Black, 78 years old, thought that it would be appropriate to fling a Whopper and then throw some racial slurs at Burger King employees over what, you may ask? That's right. The thickness of the tomato on her sandwich. That is a new one for me. We've heard of dipping sauce. We've heard that food has been too salty. But the slice of the tomato is a new one. Who would have thought? Well, Miss Black was arrested. She's already been to court, and she's received a 12-month probationary sentence and fined $785. Can you imagine the amount of tomatoes that she could have bought for $785? She could have sliced them any way she wanted. Like I said, it's not worth going into what she said because it's completely inappropriate and wrong, but I'm sure you get the gist about the racial slurs. Not appropriate, not good, and you can't call people that name. It's not good. So, Ms. Black, you are our dumb criminal contestant of the day. The question now becomes, will Ms. Black be the dumb criminal contestant of the week? You got to admit, Ms. Black is getting up there pretty high. But let's give you a quick recap, and so that you can vote in the comment section below, we will tally those and let you know who won. Now, who can forget Miss Lorraine Graves? She was wanted by the Tulsa Police Department. The Tulsa Police Department put up a post saying that she was one of the 10 most wanted people in Tulsa for her involvement in an accessory to murder charge. Miss Graves responded and basically said, "Where's the money at?" Needless to say, the Tulsa Police Department found her, and other people commented saying, "Wow, you are dumb." Sure enough, she is, and she made the dumb criminal contestant of the day. Then we had the Colorado man, Sherlyn Antonio Love, who jumped the fence at the Centennial Airport and tried to steal a Gulfstream jet while it was taxiing on the runway. Now, understand that Mr. Love had no training as a pilot whatsoever, and that he thought he could do it because he's played a few video games and thought it'd be nothing more than pushing some buttons and pulling a few levers. That was two for Monday because they were just both so stupid. Tuesday, we had Robert Perez. He was arrested while riding a stolen motorcycle, and he basically was investigation for driving under the influence, and then the officer saw him Googling how long does meth stay in your system, whereupon the officers thought, I think that's enough to get a warrant to take his blood, whereupon Mr. Perez was arrested for driving under the influence of drugs. Wednesday, William Hodge was arrested from stealing an alligator from the Congo River Golf and Exploration Center in Florida, and the police found him tossing the alligator. That's right, tossing the alligator. Then it fell to the ground, and then he stomped on the alligator as well. The alligator was unharmed, but Mr. Hodge was charged with animal cruelty as well as burglary, theft, and criminal mischief, right? Thought it was common sense. Don't feed the bears. They had to put a sign up. Now they're going to have don't throw the alligator signs, all because of Mr. Hodge. I can see it now. And then yesterday, Thursday, we had Heather Kennedy. She was in the pool of a Mr. James Clark when he arrived home, finding that there were clothes out by the pool he didn't recognize, and then found the completely nude Miss Kennedy swimming in the pool. No one knows exactly why Miss Kennedy picked Mr. Clark's pool, but she has a history of drug use and more than likely was under the influence of drugs. And like I said, finally today, Judith Black threw a Whopper and yelled racial slurs at a Burger King employee because her tomato was cut too thick. Unbelievable, ladies and gentlemen. You cannot make this stuff up. All right, it's been a busy week. We hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for watching. We know you have things that you could be doing other than watching this show, this podcast, but we appreciate you doing that. Have a wonderful week, and we'll see you next week on Crime Talk.